So this evening we're going to be exploring right livelihood. And just for context, for anyone who doesn't know, that Sims this year is going through the cycle of the Four Noble Truths, which is the truth of unsatisfactoriness, the truth of the cause of unsatisfactoriness, the truth of the possibility of freedom from that, and the Noble Eightfold Path. And the Noble Eightfold Path is right view, intention, speech, action, livelihood, effort, mindfulness, and concentration. This is what the Buddha offered to not suffer, irrespective of conditions. So right view and right livelihood is what we're talking about today. It's something I thought about a lot over the years. And it's amazing when you consider how current, how relevant what the Buddha taught about right livelihood is. It's actually quite astonishing because he taught 2,600 years ago, and here we are in the complex, technological, interconnected world of 2025, and it totally works. So there's five categories, and we'll get into that, but it's very, very completely current with what we encounter in our lives. And remember that at the time of the Buddha was a very simple, basically agrarian society, or most people simply farmed and caught stuff to eat. But it also remembered that the Buddha himself, he grew up in circles of political power, and he came out of a form of royalty. And he was very aware of the possibilities of abuse of power and livelihood and what it meant in people's minds and hearts. So what he taught about what we cultivate in terms of body, speech, and mind are at the center of the path. But because for most of us who are working, and I will humbly admit I stopped technically working in 2016, although my wife would, how do I say, counter that idea, I stopped doing anything. But livelihood, what we do, can be so much a center of our lives, how we spend our time. So it's how we approach this question is right at the center of the path. And of course, there's a funny thing about the path. We can say, you know, any one of like hundreds of things are right at the center of the path, but this one is too. Because in our waking hours as working persons, we spend more time focused on that than on any other expansive hours, right? I mean, anyone's working, it's 8 hours, whatever it is, it's a lot. So how we conduct that and the choices we make are really important. And what's unique about this fifth of the Eightfold Path, what the Buddha taught, is this is the one that's only for lay people, for non-monastics. Essentially, the Buddha was teaching monastics in everything he did. But this particular one is just for us, which is really quite astonishing, actually. Because monastics, they don't make a livelihood. They depend on the generosity of others. And in my own life, the whole question, and I'm going to talk about my, touch on my life a little bit, and insofar as it's helpful, I hope, was central because of my Dharma life. I've been practicing a long time. It was paralleling the entire time I was working. I started doing meditation when I was 20. Here I am. So it's been, you know, in parallel the entire time. And I worked mostly as a journalist for 35 years, considered a few other options. And the question of right view popped up and was clarifying often, even when there might have been more money involved. For instance, at one point, a position doing public relations for the North Pacific factory trawlers came up. And as you may know, those are the big ships that are out in front of Ballard that go up in the Bering Sea and catch huge numbers of pollock and freeze them. And I briefly considered it, and then I realized, oh my God, this is like an infrastructure killing millions of fish. And I backed away. That was not right livelihood. At Puget Sound Business Journal, I covered aerospace and Boeing for 28 years, and an area where I kept exercising discernment, tried to, was to what degree I found myself writing about weapon systems, because that's part of aerospace. I wrote about weapon systems. I used to joke I know more about weapon systems than any other Buddhist I know. I probably still do. But it's only a tiny percentage, and I was informing people rather than trafficking or profiting, but it was still something I paid attention to. Because we need to. We really need to. Took it seriously. I watched my mindfulness. I tried to make sure I wasn't being seduced by the power of the technology, because it's a slippery slope, how we identify with what we do. Then it gets tricky. You know, if we identify with what we do and we're doing something of questionable ethics, it becomes a problem. And I got to know a handful of people who worked at Boeing who were also Dharma practitioners. You know, six or seven people. And they were faced with various versions of the same question. And I think all of them worked for Boeing Commercial Airplanes, moved out of defense and space on purpose to not be working on weapons. It was pretty cool. So very consistent. Like, they made choices just for that reason. So for all of you who are still working, the question is to discern, you know, to what degree one's work, your work, is right livelihood or not. And that's a continuous process, because jobs change often right under our feet as new technologies and situations arise. So it's something, especially here in 2025, to be mindful of. And these are really Dharma questions. So it's not a part. This is where Dharma comes right into our lives. So I'm going to explore these questions in kind of two sets of areas to see if it's helpful for y'all. That's why I'm doing this. What would be helpful in terms of choices we make? So one set has to do with actions of body, speech, and mind. Thus, around action. What choices do we make around right livelihood? And the other is closely related, but it's kind of around causality and karma and the ways, the choices we make, what impacts or colorations they may bring to our state of mind, how we think, just how we carry our awareness. So let's look at what the Buddha said about livelihood. And one place where this is succinct is in the numerical discourses of the Buddha, one of the Nikayas. It's AN. He says, "Bhikkhus, a lay follower should not engage in these five trades." What five? Trading in weapons, trading in living beings, trading in meat, trading in intoxicants, and trading in poisons. A lay follower should not engage in these five trades. So it's amazing, you know, when we scan those five trades and consider the state of mind of someone choosing to do them, how, in a sense, one could say there's a similarity in the choices that folks might make. Because in general, one could say, if you look at it a certain way, there's a commonality of the perpetrator, the person, choosing their own benefit first and not caring so much about the condition or benefit of the other sentient beings that are impacted by what they do. That's kind of at the bottom line about how we approach ethics, actually. And as an aside, you know, gaining at the expense of another is also the core of the five precepts, the five ethical standards for lay people, which, as you probably know, are refraining from killing, stealing, lying, sexual misconduct, and abuse of intoxicants. And if you look at those, you can see that in each case, a person making an unethical choice is putting their own needs first. If someone steals, you steal from someone. If someone kills, you kill someone. If someone lies, you lie to someone. And in every case, we do it for our own benefit over the other person's benefit. So this suggests the degree to which right livelihood is, in fact, an ethical choice. And it's right there in the list of the Noble Eightfold Paths. And we can think of this as in two ways, one of having to do with impacts on others, but also impacts on ourselves. What happens in our mind stream if we engage in wrong livelihood? And in terms of others, you know, Buddhist cosmology considers all sentient beings, people and all sentient beings as equal and with capacity to awaken. So in this way, every sentient being is as sacred as another. And the Bodhisattva ideal is a commitment to awaken for the sake of all sentient beings, to awaken to lead others to awakening. So therefore, any action that would hurt or damage another sentient being, which we might do to get some kind of, you know, goodie for ourselves, is it going in exactly the opposite direction of awakening for the sake of all sentient beings. So it's a big deal. You know, the ethical thing is a big deal. And this right livelihood's a big deal. Because if we're really on the path, we really want to awaken, we really want to be benefit, then we would not ever do anything that would be detrimental to another being. So all five of the activities that the Buddha considered wrong livelihood are trading that directly or indirectly hurts others. It somehow monetizes or generates revenue because of some damage to another. So that's bad karma. And in terms of damage to ourselves, then you kind of look at the central teachings on non-self and how not-self is essential for awakening. We'll touch on this in a different way later, but think for a minute how our sense of self kind of thickens or thins depending on choices we make. You know, if you ever take a dollar bill that belongs to someone else, or even take the biggest slice of pie at a potluck, if you get that little kind of little squinchy feeling like, oh, I kind of got it, and you see this little thing kind of harden inside yourself because you got the big piece of pie, as opposed to leaving the biggest piece of pie for others, it gets tight. There's something dark happens. It's pretty amazing. You go in the opposite. It's like, anybody read Lord of the Rings? Okay, so Gollum, right? Gollum, seeking my precious, and it just made him dark and twisted and congested and kind of congealed. We're all dancing that dance, ethically, and it comes right into this area of right livelihood. Because in any way we participate in wrong livelihood, profiting from the pain or loss of another, it concretizes ourselves. And it takes us in the opposite direction of not clinging, the opposite direction of awakening. On the other hand, generosity of any sort, putting others before themselves, you know, the many people who choose a livelihood that's benefiting others, whether it's counseling or being a doctor, all that kind of stuff, that lightens their hearts if they do it in a generous way, really caring. So it's a big deal. This is important. And it's worth considering how much here in 2025, how much our understanding of these, what it means, is kind of conditioned by the, you know, the technology, the politics, the currency of what's happening now. So we'll go through the list. So weapons, trading in weapons. At the time of the Buddha, the question of what was a weapon and what was not was pretty straightforward. He grew up as a princeling. He got trained in how to use the weapons of the time. He knew how to wield a sword, a club, a spear, an arrow. He knew how to do that. Those were the weapons then. They're hand tools. And the intention was to kill or maim another with the hand tools. But now in 2025, the boundaries are way more complex. And we need to get subtle about whether what one is doing is somehow trading in weapons. And always central is a question of intent. You know, what's our intent? It's always central. Now, because of Boeing, you know, Boeing doesn't develop as many weapon systems in this region as it once did. Once upon a time, during World War II, they were cranking out B-17 bombers, as some of you know, down near in Duwamish River. And even in the 90s, they were building the wings for the F-22 fighters here in the Seattle area. So they don't do that stuff, but still, they assemble 767-based tankers here up in Everett, P-8 submarine killers based on a, you know, Boeing 737, you fly Alaska Airlines, go to Hawaii, 737. Those things are also submarine killers called P-8s, and they make them into those here. So stuff's happening, right? Stuff's happening in this area as we speak. And there's people down the aerospace supply chain making parts. Are they making weapons? got to pay attention, you know? We all got to pay attention. What if they're writing the code that makes those things work? We got to be aware. It's very interesting. You know, if we're Microsoft working on Windows and games and whatever, may seem benign, but what if that code's being used in a weapon system? Are we then participating in making weapons? And, you know, Blue Origin, that's Jeff Bezos' space company, Blue Origin, based in Kent, is mostly commercial, whereas SpaceX has a satellite system in Redmond, a big satellite system place, and they do work on Starlink, which is how you connect, but they also work on something called Starshield, which is totally military, in Redmond. So that's in the weapons arena. So it's really neat to, it gets subtle, right? We have to pay attention, all you all workers, all you all coders. Anybody coders here? Anybody? Yeah. East side, inside, when I say that, like half the hands go up. So it's pretty funny. And, you know, I had a learning here because the blunt truth is that weapon systems, even if they're called defense, are actually intended to kill. And I woke up to this in a funny sort of many, many decades ago when, as a journalist, the Navy flew a bunch of local journalists out in a big Chinook helicopter out to the Nimitz, which is some of you may know as the flagship, the biggest, the Nimitz class aircraft carriers are the biggest in the world currently. I think there's another one coming up now, but at that time they were. And this was the flagship, the Nimitz, going from Bremer, going from Port Angeles back to Seattle. So we got on board the Nimitz. And the things that it's, you know, it's nuclear powered. It's 1,000 feet long, has a crew of 6,000 people in terms of sailors and pilots. And it's just like a floating city. And I've got this sort of nautical background. So the first couple hours on board, I thought, oh, this is cool. I was kind of like, I was into it. And then suddenly it dawned on me that this was actually the largest killing machine in the world. That's what I was on. I was on the largest killing machine in the world. And I was like, oh my God. And the last couple hours were pretty difficult because I really got it. And it was hard to bear. That's what this thing was about, you know? So the scales can fall from our eyes and we need to stay alert. You know, so if we're working in technology or aerospace or AI or whatever we're doing to discern to the degree to which what we're doing might shade into weaponry and really pay attention to the choices we make. It's really relevant for any of you all. What about trading in living beings? That's a second thing we're not supposed to do. And at the time of the Buddha, especially if we're talking about humans, beings, prostitution and slavery were way common, of course. They still are now, to varying degrees, but it was just kind of part of the culture then. And we, as we develop our livelihoods, we need to stay attuned to any way we might be shading into this, to think, consider, you know, hidden violations. Are we working for a company that sells products made in prisons in China or made by child labor somewhere? You know, we got to pay attention to that. How much are we participating? Because it colors our minds and it'll push us. If we pay attention, it'll push us, lead us into making better choices, which will help our states of mind, which will help us help others. I mean, the ways that in our complex world, where there's all kinds of smoke and mirrors, the ways that trading in humans can be surprising. And I stumbled upon this. So here's a tiny bit of history. The French, so Haiti, the country Haiti, as you know, Haiti's a train wreck right now, right? I mean, it just almost has no government. In 1825, there was a slave revolution in Haiti because they were slaves. It was a French colony. They basically kicked the French out and became independent. But it wasn't as simple as that. The French exacted reparations, which is crazy. They had to pay the French reparations for losing their plantations in which the slaves had been imprisoned, which was about $500 million then, which was crazy how much money that is. But economists have looked at the impact that on Haiti in terms of not being able to reinvest. It was just pouring money out of Haiti. They couldn't put it into the country. It adds up to like $115 billion out of Haiti's economy over time. And then irony is that the 1889 construction of the Eiffel Tower was largely funded by this money coming from Haiti, which is a symbol, you know, of French liberty. But doesn't it make your heart ache? So we just need to pay attention, you know, just pay attention. Look at where the money trail goes. Look at things we're doing. Are we trading in beings? What about business in meat? That's a subtle question, very much involved in intent. And the Buddha wasn't exactly vegetarian, nor are most monks, because monastics, they take what's offered to them. And people offer what they offer, you know? They offer what they eat. In Thailand, people eat some fish, depending on where they live. But the question of doing business in animals for the sake of their meat, that becomes important for choices that we make in terms of right livelihood. You know, and it's complicated. My in-laws, they were from Montana, and it was part of their culture and understanding that animals are kind of like objects, are kind of like tractors and trucks to be used for farming. They didn't think of it in the same way that, you know, me and my, at that time, vegetarian wife thought of it. And even now, I mean, Ellen and I drive across the country, Route 26, once in a while, across Washington State, and near Othello, there's this huge area where cattle are fattened. And we always do prayers for them because they're fattened to be slaughtered so folks can eat them. It's a killing field. And just a glimpse of this, you know, this huge meat-producing industry that treats animals like food objects, not sentient beings, not beings who could awaken. And then another aspect of this is traffic in wild animals, you know, all over the world for a supposed medical benefit, for people's eating enjoyment. They do that, and, you know, our brothers and sisters in China do that a lot. So it's universal. As we become more aware, we become more aware of the consciousness of animals. And thus the whole notion of trading in them for our benefit becomes more and more anathema. As part of the deepening of practice. It's interesting that most, you know, can I ask how many people are vegetarian? Pretty much, yeah. Good bunch of hands, right? Not that it's bad or good necessarily, but worth looking at. You know, you should be able to, anything you eat, can you look it in the eyeball and feel okay about eating it? And it's interesting that as we become more aware, as we're cultivating mindfulness, we become more aware of the subtle emotions, the subtle awareness of our animal friends. It seems like a lot of folks, if they don't practice, that just, they don't even get it. Although I got to say, here in 2025, in the midst of difficulties, you can see that growing. You look on YouTube and there's like a billion incredibly cute animals about gorillas handing the child back to the mom in the zoo and all kinds of stuff like that. There's a way in which there is growing awareness. We just want to be on the right side of that. And, you know, maybe animals don't have words, but they want to be happy. They want to avoid pain. They care for their young. They know if we're acting kindly towards them. They know if they're approaching them with harsh intent. We all know that. My wife and I, our dog is Annie. Our cat is Arizel. And they're so attuned to us that if we just even have the slightest edge of disagreement, they are like gone. They just get out of the room. They just can't handle it. It's like, come on, guys, can you just stick around? But nope, they're out of there. And it was, sometimes we even, oh gosh, we must be getting uptight. They just left, you know? So it's really amazing. It's gotten me more and more aware of how they're just sentient beings. They just don't have the words thing. So to trade in their bodies, that's pretty intense. And, you know, maybe we do or don't think of rebirth as fact. And as a tiny aside, I will say that just this weekend, I was on there's an organization, tiny aside, the International Association of Near-Death Studies, called IANS, which studies NDEs, and their annual conference was in Chicago, and I did it online all weekend. And what's interesting, the reason why I'm bringing this up, is because this is the 50th anniversary of Dr. Raymond Moody first wrote the book Life After Life and coined the term NDE. And most of the people, I mean, this is not, when they say International Association of Near-Death Studies, these are actually academics. I mean, most of the stuff are like academics at the University of Virginia and all over the world. And there's a real thinking that the body of evidence is moving toward continuity of consciousness. I mean, a whole bunch of scientists and MDs were speaking at this thing, and they say, it's getting really close now where we can say, yes, we're convinced, science is convinced that there is continuity of consciousness after death. It's pretty amazing. Pretty amazing. Therefore, in terms of trading in animals, from Buddha's point of view, animals and humans are just among the forms of sentient beings. And then we and our loved ones have been many forms. So the whole question of trafficking in animals becomes much closer to home. Tibetan Buddhists, they stress, they talk about this a lot, that if we've had infinitely many lifetimes, then every sentient being has been our mother. Everyone. Your dog, that's been your mother. That crab, that's been your mother. And it makes a real kind of, ooh, makes you rethink the eating them. Hi, mom, chomp. You know, I mean, it's deep to really take in that these sentient beings have exactly the same value as we do, and to trade in them, because we're talking about the livelihood, to trade in them gets really difficult. So what if your very livelihood was taking the lives of these beings? What does that do to our minds? I saw a video about in China, God, they built these, it's hard to describe what it is. It's like an apartment block for raising pigs. These things that are like 7 stories high, 1,000 feet long, multiple floors, and the pigs are born and they move down through these floors over their lifetime, and then they kill them at the bottom. Never get outside. It's just a giant pig raising factory. And so there's some video inside, and I saw the vibes of some of the people who work there. And man, that was dark. Not that they were evil people, but it was affecting them. They somehow got it, what they were doing. It really struck me. It's like, oh man, these people are in pain. And it's just like, it's like almost like a caricature of how bad it can get, these kind of systems. Then moving on, there's a way we can group together livelihood based on selling intoxicants and poisons, because they're kind of similar here in 2025. You know, other than organic foods or at least wholesome foods, most of the stuff we humans sell to each other to ingest are either poisons or intoxicants to some degree. I mean, there's alcohol, but what about, you know, energy drinks or fast foods filled with additives or all kind of recreational drugs or just the endless drinks and confections, you know, marshmallows and, I don't know, stupid cereals you'll see, but they're just candy. More destructive than helpful. Not to mention actual poisons, whether they're herbicides or rodent killers that are sold for no other reason than to kill sentient beings. And then you could get a little metaphorical, because what about the entertainment industry in all of its myriad forms? It's kind of creating intoxicants. And it's no mistake that the term, sometimes it's amazing how the evolution of English language reveals, it has Dharma reveals. So the terms binge watching, right? It's like, oh, wait, binge drinking, binge watching, I guess they're kind of the same. And so there's a way in which all that stuff is an intoxicant. You know, if people just are not being mindful, they're sucked in for X number of hours. So it's worth knowing. I have a friend of mine who's in screenwriting for a while. And he just said, man, I'm out of there. He just said, it's just creating stuff to distract people. He's actually moving into politics. I hope it works. But in a good, he's, anyway. So again, choices, you know, if you work in a hardware store, do we have to be removed from the pesticide area for religious reasons? Maybe we do. That might be okay. That might actually fly. But we gotta think about it. So I want to explore briefly how these choices manifest, how they land in our spiritual journey, in our hearts and minds, on the Dharma path. One aspect is the degree to which these are actions. And as many of you know, the word karma means action. So choices we make, what do we do? What do we do? Actions of body, speech, and mind. So action doesn't mean body just, it's body, speech, and mind. So our mind is conditioned by our choices in body, speech, and mind. And then here in this area of livelihood, we're sort of turning now to how these choices affect us on the Dharma path, right? How we make our living influences our conditions of mind and thus our progress or not on the path. So think of this hierarchy for a minute. So body, for starters, all these five prohibited areas are done on a physical plane, acts of body. So in one way, that's kind of straightforward. Don't do that stuff. You know, don't write the code. Don't sell the weapon. That's pretty straightforward. But then it gets subtler, because what if you're not trading in these five in your own hands, but instead you're telling someone else to do it? What if you're, you know, you're a supervisor, you're on Zoom, you're telling your employees to do X? That's getting into the speecher area in a way. And we need to be attentive, because there's a way in which, if we're consciously aware that we're telling someone else to trade in meat, we're equally culpable. Just because we're not killing the chickens, if we're having them killed, it also colors our mind. And mind is really kind of where this goes in terms of the spiritual journey, because our progress on the path is based on, connected to, rooted in our states of mind. And then here in the 21st century, we're in a world of software and coding and the internet and everything, the world of mind kind of interpenetrates with actions of body and speech as never before. We may be far away from any overt action. Like, for instance, the way military pilots who kill people who are, you know, terrorists in the Middle East from computer consoles in the Midwest flying drones to kill people. It happens right now. It's probably happening right as we speak. And all this matters because the Dharma path is about cause and effect, about how our conditions create karma and states of mind, how they impact our mind conditioning. And I've read about these drone pilots, and they can be really traumatized. They're at very high. You think that PTSD is because you're in a war zone and someone's shooting at you. But, you know, honoring people's conscience, it's a lot of what happens to people when they're doing damaging thing. And the freaky thing, there's actually a very high incidence of PTSD among remote drone pilots, and it's because, in a weird kind of way, they bond with the people they're killing. They're hovering and watching this guy play soccer with his kid, and then they kill him. Whereas if you're running a, you know, shooting some kind of artillery 100 or 30 miles away, you don't see that, but they see it. So distance isn't a factor. It's what we do, body, speech, and mind, how it affects our mind stream. So just on a conventional level, any of these five less, you know, avoid them livelihood areas can have a powerful conditioning effect on how we live and the Dharma outcomes we might have. And if rebirth is part of how we think, how we might be reborn, then the karmic links get pretty powerful. We can see closely how these are tied to the core precepts, especially not killing. And breaking those precepts can drive us into lower realms, if that's part of how you understand things. And cultivating kindness and compassion toward others is so essential to awakening. We cultivate loving kindness. We cultivate compassion. So essential to getting out of our attachment or not clinging and awakening. So the opposite would be anything that brings harm to others. So the harm to others implied in these five unbeneficial livelihoods is at the core of why the Buddha said, avoid them. He was always, always, everything he said was helping people awaken, helping them move towards awakening for the sake of all sentient beings. So when he's clearly saying, don't do these things. He's saying, because it's going to push you in the wrong direction. So this is so helpful in a way because, you know, I hope many of you have some kind of daily practice, meditation practice. You sit, that's wonderful. What do we do the rest of the time? It's a big deal. It's pivotal. And this is one aspect of that that we can really make choices about, that we can change. It's as important as going on retreat. It's as important as sitting on the cushion. And it gets to the subtlest aspect, the mind itself, cultivating purity and clarity of mind itself. Because the Buddha saw that, you know, our potential for awakening is just hidden behind layers of obscurations. I mean, every one of us is a Buddha. We just don't see it because we're covered by layers of obscurations, lifetimes and lifetimes. And part of our practice is moment by moment not grasping. That's what mindfulness practice is. Something comes up, you don't grasp it. You're aware of it, but you don't grasp it. You slowly peel away that which is obscuring. But to do this peeling away, we need to keep purifying our minds. And this business of purifying our livelihoods, and thus our minds, is truly part of practice. And in some ways, a huge area that we can make choices about. We have some freedom. We're very fortunate we have some freedom here in this part of the world, this time in history, to make choices about this. Bhikkhu Bodhi, great translator and monk, he says, in the Buddha's teaching, the criteria of genuine enlightenment lies precisely in purity of mind. The purpose of all insight and enlightened understanding is to liberate the mind from the defilements, and the Nibbana itself, the goal of the teaching, is defined quite clearly as freedom from greed, hatred, and delusion. So in closing, you know, let's look at our livelihoods, the choices we make as sacred questions, how we earn our daily bread, how that conditions our mind and karma is at the heart of our journey on the path. Let's just sit for a minute. Okay, you got a little time for any discussions or thoughts. Going to leave a little time at the end to dedicate the merit for Jean. And are there any announcements, by the way, just so I can factor that in to timing? I guess not. Okay. So, this fine human here has a microphone. Thank you so much. And if you're all online, you know, if you can raise your digital hand, you pop up in the queue and we can see you. So that'd be cool. Suze.
So my question is a bit of, it might sound like I'm rationalizing and excusing having a livelihood that fits into those categories. But as I think about most people, they need to get work, and they get the work that's available to them. And I feel like I and a lot of people who come to Seattle Insight, we're in a privileged community, many with college degrees and specific kinds of training that allows them to do work that is kind of pure.
Right.
But the reality is that people need to earn a living in to take care of themselves, their families, have enough, you know, food, housing. And there's a kind of judgmentalism. In here we are in our world where a lot of people are lucky and have had advantages and can do work that is so kind of clean. And it's not for everybody. And so how do we deal with that?
It's a matter of degree. It's a matter of growth. It's a matter of incremental choices. I hear you. Yeah. But, you know, people do make choices. And even within, you know, certainly you're right. We're privileged here. No question about it. But people make choices, and it's not bad or good. You know, there's no such thing as sort of bad or good in any moral concretized way. But in terms of what has impacts on our subtle mindstream and how we grow, that's choices people can make. And even, you know, somebody in some tiny town in North Dakota, they can maybe decide if they're going to work on the local slaughter yard, or they're going to work in the local nursing home, even if they don't make as much. You know, people make choices like that a lot. So somewhere in there, it's an area to navigate. And, you know, my sense of people on the path, it gets more, I'm struck often by, as people journey on the path, they start shedding things that they used to do. And they find new ways to make choices. So that's sort of why I keep talking about stay attuned, pay attention. You know, it's not black and white, right? And I'm sure many things that I've done have had colorations of wrong livelihood that I didn't see. But, and yeah. What's your name?
Tara Lee.
Tara Lee.
Yeah. Hi, Tara. Actually, the question that was just asked sort of prompted me to think about this. I'm not actually sure if it's exactly a question, but I'm thinking about how complicated the modern world has gotten in terms of, I just started thinking about this because I'm working on like some retirement investment stuff, and it got me thinking about, oh wait, where is that money going? What is that account? Where, and really complex things like, oh sure, real estate. That sounds like a wise thing to invest. Oh wait, do they evict people? What do I know? Do I get to know? I just was thinking about how, and I'm not actually prone to disagree with you about choice, but actually that the modern world makes it feel choiceless. Like people don't know where their money came from that they inherited that gave them the down payment on their house or what. Like they really don't know sometimes.
Right.
And then that got me thinking about reparations, and it feels like there are things about the modern world that have made it harder to determine where is this money coming from that's helping you keep a roof over your head, and then where is your money going when you spend it? It just feels all like tangled up and
it
messy.
Is all tangled. No, you're absolutely right. It is all tangled up, and I mean, there's sort of, I think there's, how do I say, conventional and ultimate ways of looking at that. I mean, there are investment mechanisms that avoid certain kinds of investments and stuff like that, if that's something that moves you. But then in a more immediate sense is really the question of just, you know, here in this moment, going ahead, the question, whatever the inheritance came from, here we are. And now what do we do? Mm-hmm. And maybe we're a little more generous because of it. Maybe we give some more to charity or something, knowing that it came from, I'm just making this up, but, you know, and then just what do we do now? Because it's not black and white, right or wrong, but it's really about intention. Mm-hmm. It's about love, and each unique situation, navigating it here in 2025 as best we can, fully acknowledging, you know, almost, I mean, like, Europe's crazy. I mean, I've really gotten this very, because almost every wonderful building in Europe was built on the backs of colonialism. Got it. Or oppression of serfs or whatever. Got it. So having said that, it's a beautiful building. But also to know that and release and send love and make choices. So somewhere in there, you know, I've been trying to emphasize the complexity, but in sort of an open, sort of loving, kind of simple way. Mm-hmm. Complex and simple somehow. Yeah, but these are great questions. Yeah. So I want to make sure any Zoom person's hand up, feel free. Okay, I got a hand back there. And one over here, a whole bunch of hands, so cool. And what's your name?
I'm Quincy.
Quincy, howdy.
Yeah. I just want to say I really enjoyed your lecture. What they just said, I was thinking about, you know, as we think about how complex our economy is, and all of the kind of infrastructure that allows us to even have a trade in the first place and allows us to have a job. You know, recently, just for context, I recently worked in construction at the administrative level. So I was, you know, telling people where to put concrete or where to do something. And it just got me thinking, because the work that I was doing, I wasn't necessarily actually doing something with my hands. But again, going back to what you're saying, the infrastructure that and the materials that are used, from my perspective, are poison, because they poison water and earth, which then gets into either the soil we grow our food in or the waters that fish are in. And even beyond that, like just the economy as a whole, using that those resources that were extracted usually with underpaid labor, it becomes almost, going back to what she was saying, like it's like you can't, the work you're actually doing is so disconnected from your own, it feels like you don't have a choice, because you're just using the things that are in front of you. You have all these tools and materials in front of you, but you don't have a choice really on what to use. It's just you have to use what's available to you to make money. So that's was a very long-winded.
And what choices are you making? Are you still? It sounded like you said you were doing that.
I quit. Yeah.
Pardon me. You quit?
I quit.
So, I mean, I want to pry in your, you know, but is there any aspect of that that had to do with the direction that you're cultivating, or sounds like you've thought about it quite a bit?
I have, yeah. I mean, the only choice I felt like I had was to stop working.
Mm-hmm.
From my perspective, I'm just wondering what your thoughts were about that. On kind of the infrastructure of how we trade and how we work.
Right. No, it's hard, but it might, I mean, who knows? It feels like that's an aspect that you may be incorporating in your evolving direction now. You know, I'd love to talk to you in a few years and see where you go. But it sounds like you're aware, you know, and that's an aspect of the choices you're making. Was that fair? I'm just kind of feeding back here. Yeah, good. May it go well. And it's not black and white, is it? And a lot of it has to do with intention, you know, to really look at your intention as a spiritual being. And, okay, you know, ask almost, like ask in your heart and mind, what should I be doing? See what you see. Yeah.
I thought it was very interesting how everyone was bringing the point, but would if you rather have someone who is cognizant of how they're affecting the environment and construction? He's aware that what he's putting into the ground is bad, versus someone else who might have taken his position now is not as cognizant of it and would actively, you know, say, oh, well, no, climate change or something, you know, like someone who wouldn't be as caring. Wouldn't you rather, I mean, this is like, you know, it's not black and white, but wouldn't it be better to have someone with his point of view in that position that he would someday find a solution perhaps, mm-hmm. versus someone who might not be as cognizant of what they're doing to the environment who are in these positions.
You know? Yep. I guess yes and yes, or, you know, yeah. And it might, that person might change. They might come up with a new system. They might, you know, it's amazing to watch people like change careers. It's always really interesting. I know a whole bunch of people who are lawyers and stop being lawyers because they didn't want to. It was just like, I talked one guy who was this real powerful former vet, very powerful type A kind of person. And he said, I was just killing people. He said, I just didn't want to do that anymore, and he shifted in the, he has a sort of an administrative role, but he's, there was a certain brutality in what he was doing that he didn't want to do anymore. But on the other hand, someone could be a lawyer and, you know, right, it's all subtle. Okay, I'm encouraging the online folks, but it's all good. I'm happy that you're here. is a very active room here. Whoops, I just popped into the big room. Okay.
It looks like there's somebody online.
Is there someone with a hand up?
Yeah.
Okay. Hand went down. All right. Well, this fine person with a blue sweater.
I'm Anne.
Anne.
I was just thinking about, I love this topic and I appreciate the talk. And I think about the supervising aspect. So you're not one is like, I am not personally doing whatever.
Right.
But I'm supervising someone who is, or I'm supervising making it, you know, and then that makes me think of the whole political system. Like we are part of a political system that, you know, kills people.
Right.
And, you know, masked people go and kidnap people and incarcerate them. So, yeah, I mean, it just makes me think about, you know, it's kind of like, wow, it's just like so overwhelming because it's like what you do, how you invest your, you know, and you're supervising, and then you're part of a political system that's also just, heinous. I don't know. Yeah. Anyway, I don't.
Yeah. I mean, it's an area of, you know, it's where we cultivate love and compassion, where we're on the path. The mere fact that we're here, you know, this group of people is a conscious circle of people. And navigating the very complete, you know, you pay taxes. It goes into weapons. I get that. You know, so, but still there's choices. There's all kinds of levels of choices. And we just navigate, keep our antenna, be as aware as we can. You know, you weren't making weapons. You were building buildings, it sounds like. So, still better. So, sometimes better is as good as we got right now. So
just paying attention and doing what you can.
Yeah.
All the things, yeah.
Yeah, and see what, you know, I sometimes I think that we can be, I mean, divinely guided is kind of a big phrase, but if we really pay attention and really ask inwardly, I'm amazed sometimes talking to people over the decades that the forks in the road that they chose and they suddenly had an idea, wait, I could do this, or wait, I don't want to do that, I want to do this, and it's amazing, you know, and when people keep asking and looking, sometimes people do extraordinary shifts that surprised them. And if they're on an inner path that led them in a much brighter contributory direction and away from, in particular, these five things, which are, you know, probably all of us aren't doing any of those five things, but there may be shades of them in what we're doing and the way our jobs or whatever are right now. It's complicated. Yeah, thank you. Yes, sir. A gentleman here. That gentleman being Justin.
Hi. Let's see. I guess seems like maybe kind of a common theme is the lines of harm being a little bit blurry. I guess kind of along these lines, something that I struggled with a little bit is I've been working in a research lab that is developing treatments for opioid addiction and opioid overdose. And I'd say that's a kind of a pressing issue that's causing a lot of suffering right now. And it's like an important thing that, you know, it relieves a lot of suffering. I'd say overall that's kind of right livelihood. But also an inherent part of that is, you know, if you're developing treatments to treat opioid overdose, kind of an inherent part of that is intentionally causing harm to animals to test the treatments.
I knew that's where you were going, yeah.
And then killing those animals when you're done with them. And so far, my approach to that is that I just don't do that part of it. I won't kill the animals, but I just don't. I work with mostly with cells. Although I still am, you know, sometimes I will be loading up syringes with fentanyl that I know is going to be used later. Somebody else is going to take that and overdose a mouse with it to see if they can revive them from the overdose. But then at the same time, this is hopefully going to prevent a lot of suffering in the future.
Yeah, and that's why I keep talking about intention. Because that is one of the balancing points, you know, and it is, you're right, it is an effort, you know, with regrettable difficulty for these animals, and at the same time, it's a benefit for beings further on, we hope. Yeah, you might go talk to the animals and apologize, seriously, you know, if you have a chance.
That's not a bad idea.
Huh?
That's not a bad idea.
Yeah, give them some love and, you know, explain to them what's happening and thank them for their efforts to, you know, their...
I've never actually seen them. I haven't gone down.
There you go.
Well, so maybe I should do that.
Yeah, it's a thought. You know, it really is a thought. Yeah, yeah. But right. I mean, that's, how's that for a perfect case of not black and white? Yeah, sometimes it's just like that. Yeah.
Yeah. Because, like, I think about it, and, like, on one hand, I guess maybe the Buddhist side of me wants to say that, you know, that not to create a distinction, like, what's to say that a human life is more valuable than the life of a mouse? But on the other hand, then my human perspective says that the lives of the mice are worth being sacrificed to be able to, you know, treat such a serious issue among our species.
Or it might benefit more sentient beings. In Tibetan world, they say a funny thing. They say, well, if you're going to eat an animal, eat a big one. Like, eat one ox instead of 100 shrimp. So there's that point of view, too. You know, just how many sentient beings, and right?
Yeah, but intention, I thought in the context, just broadly, of, like, trying to reduce harm, trying to do the least amount of harm possible.
But it's in terms of the, you know, the inner work, the inner journey. I mean, I know that you're a sincere practitioner, so you're staying aware and alert and attuned and loving, and just watch where that takes you. You know, watch what you decide to do or not do and how to navigate that. And, you know, relative to what Suze was saying, I mean, maybe the guys working in the giant plant in China killing pigs, that's the best job they can get, and they have a family and they have a sick child and they have to, you know. But bringing your practice into the choices you have to make can illuminate what to do. None of it's perfect, probably, unless you're a monk and you're not working at all. But other than that, in the great...
Well, even the monks have to eat meat.
Yeah, they eat what they give them. Yeah, yeah. So you're right. I mean, but they're not doing consciously choosing, but they have to eat what's given them. It does say in the Vinaya, the rules of monastics, that they can eat meat, but they can't have something killed for them. That's a very specific rule of the Vinaya. They can't have something killed for them, which is a big change. I went to a Chinese restaurant once, God, where was it, in Guangzhou, and I didn't quite get it. And I'm in there, and suddenly I realize there's all these animals slithering around the floor. And it's like, what's this about? And they say, oh, which one shall we kill for you? And I was like, my friends, I'm out of here. Sorry. But at the same time, I would have eaten a fish if it hadn't been them killing it for me, you know, so... Blurry line. Yeah. Pay attention. Any, oh, we have a hand. Emery.
Hi,
maybe
there.
We can pop this up to full screen, or I guess I can do that. Let me see. Can I pin you, Emery? I can. Okay. Hi, Emery.
Hi. Thank you so much.
I can't hear you, however. What's going on? Hang on a sec. You just chill. We have our highly expert soundboard person. Try it now.
Hello?
You're getting there.
Hi.
Yeah. Sounds good enough.
Okay. Great. Thanks so much, Steve. I had not heard very much about right livelihood before, so I appreciate this a lot. And I have never heard the Buddhist teaching before that any sentient being has the potential for awakening.
Mm. Yeah.
And I just, that was news to me, and it seems like such a beautiful awareness to walk through the world with. And I'm just wondering if you can teach a little bit more about that, or where that came from, or what it means.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, it's interesting. It's a wonderful question. We're, you know, technically in Theravada world here, but it's actually universal across, well, I know mostly about Tibetan tradition and Theravada, so I can't say about Pure Land exactly, but the Buddha talks, Buddhist cosmology talks six realms of beings, six realms that sentient beings go in and out of. And it's the human realm, the animal realm, the hungry ghosts, the Asura realm, the hell realms, and the devas. Is that six? And so from that, and you'll see these in Tibetan world, you see these big wheels. Ever seen those? The tankas that are a big wheel? That's, and so the sectors, that's the six realms of being that from a Buddhist point of view we're going in and out of. And even though it isn't talked about in, and they don't have the visualization in Theravada, it's actually exactly the same. Sometimes it's five where the Asuras and the Devas are, they're basically sort of spirit beings are mushed into one and sometimes they're separated. So five or six. But from that point of view, from that understanding, you know, when we die, I mean, you know, since you asked, when we die, there's, especially from a Tibetan point of view, there's 49 days, we're in between, like Jean, from that point of view, is kind of in between, and then we'll reborn as a human, as an animal, in a hell realm, depending on what we do, what the coloration of our mind and our karma is. Yeah, so it's humbling. And from that point of view, we've been doing it for, you know, infinitely many lifetimes and many world systems, maybe even in expansions and contractions of universe before the Big Bang, even. So it's a big deal. Yeah. And that's sort of the journey of awakening, is to be free of having to do that again and again and again and again and again. Yes. Thank you for asking that. Any other speak? Any other online hands? Guess not. Anybody here in person? What time are we? Almost there anyway. Since we're in a Quaker place, I always think a moment of silence to see what arises is very appropriate. Do we have a, did a hand went up and I didn't notice? A physical hand. Oh, my God, that's crazy. Anne-Marie, go for it. Yay. I love that. That's so radical.
I am looking everywhere on my display, and I can't figure out how to
I hear you.
Raise my little
No, that's hand, great. So. Boing, there you are. Yeah.
I'm sorry. So I will preface this with I've only been introduced to or practicing Buddhism for the past year, and so all of this is quite new. And you took all of this in a direction I wasn't anticipating tonight. I was very surprised. And so I have so many questions, but I think I will try to just do one for right now. But the piece I was going to share when we're talking about satient beings is just I've moved away from the news for the past year and just, you know, doing the death scrolling on my phone and things like that. And so what I have done instead is I've loaded a lot of podcasts that are all about nature and YouTube channels. They're all about reestablishing whether it's coral reefs or, you know, trees and desert, not desert, but animals. And so there are these, for me, there are these really positive pieces. And one of the things I've come across in these podcasts is that there's so much science now pointing towards plants being satient beings. And it's really fascinating with trees. When they're being cut down, they will flush out their carbohydrates to all their little treelets around, right? And you know, when one is sick, the other trees will give it more nourishment to help it recover when it's attacked by a beetle or something. And so I think with science, we're also learning that plants are satient beings. And so with that knowledge now that is unfolding, it's like, well, what do we eat then? And like you, what you keep coming back to is, and I think other people have touched on it, is just an awareness around what we're eating, you know, and you had asked who's vegetarian, who's not vegetarian. And that's one of my questions of, we're designed with grinding teeth and tearing teeth. And so to say that, you know, to choose one over the other is more enlightened, I guess, I don't know the right words, is just kind of an interesting perspective to me. And so I really always come back to the intention. And I think of that scene in the Indian in the cupboard where the Native American, the little Native American guy kills the deer. And then he gives a blessing. Thank you for your life, for nourishing me and my family. And so I guess I just really wanted to share about these podcasts that I'm listening to that are so science-based, that plants, you know, it's like the way they send out their roots is they learn where the light is, and that's where their roots will start going. You know, instead of, we would think that they would go out evenly, but that's not what's happening. They're learning, and they're doing something very specific to what they're learning. And so I guess I just wanted to drop that in our conversation. And again, like you keep saying, and others, it's the awareness of do we give thanks, and what's our intention, and right. Do we know the care and the kindness that was given to that animal? Years ago, somebody told me they didn't at fast food places because the product was so high stressed. Meat products and animal products that then that went into the high stress of, you know, like somebody earlier was saying, somebody who's poor and has to take that job. And then we are then consuming all of this high stress from the animal, from the person. And so, yeah, how do we have that awareness, and how do we bring it to a place of center and wish good towards.
No, that's really beautiful. I thank you so much. And and, you know, it's not so much a question and a show, but a sharing. And just a few thoughts is that I've got my wife is a little bit Native and Native American and probably Algonquin. And it's sort of been in my karma a lot for some reason. So for one thing, in terms of, you know, the question of killing an animal in order to eat it, you're absolutely right. Here in the Northwest, you know, the attitudes of Native people towards salmon are extremely, with great respect, mm-hmm. killing this animal and thanking it. And mm-hmm. it's quite an extraordinary thing. And I'm actually, I know a number of people, I'm sort of vegan except for salmon. And I try to approach it in that same way because it is part of our sacred Northwest heritage. And my wife and I, we spent 5 days in the Hopi Nation in the spring, our second time there on a pilgrimage in the Southwest. The Hopi Nation, if you ever have a chance, it's amazing. It's inside of the Navajo. The Navajo reservation is as big as Rhode Island, and the Hopi Nation is inside of it. So you've got a whole world, and the Hopi Nations, they're extraordinary. There's no commercial. So one place you can stay was at the Hopi Cultural Center run by the tribe. There's no commercial hotels there. And we get a chance to spend a little time with elders, a couple of elders, two elders. And what struck me, relative to what you're saying, is here when we think of loving kindness, we, you know, we white folks, there's a sense in which we're thinking of loving kindness toward other. But from the way they were talking about there, I mean, Walpi Village is the oldest inhabited village in North America. It's been there 1,200 years, Walpi Village in the Hopi Nation. And the whole sense of integration with the rocks and the plant beings and the living beings, there's almost no distinction. So I don't know, you know, about rebirth and whether plants are reborn. I have no idea. But in terms of attitude, which is sort of what this is about, in terms of intention, which is sort of the core, as you said, of what I was sharing was about, that part is so beautiful. And we can really, I think the very stuff you're talking about is amazing. We become more and more aware of how almost conscious plants are, or maybe they are, or they act like they are, or they interconnect in extraordinary ways. We had no idea in the past. So it's in the middle of, you know, the darkness and difficulty of 2025 and climate change and all that stuff, there's also incredibly growing awareness of the interconnectedness. So thank you so much for your great wisdom. I don't believe it. You've only been doing this for a year. I think you've been doing this for lifetimes. Thank you.